the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, and this is our kind of weekly conversation, which we look at what's going on in the world around us, and we try to think about it from the perspective of our Catholic values, our Catholic social teaching, if we wanted to get a little bit more formal and fancy about it. And this week, we're going to concentrate on another one of those environmental issues, which Pope Francis has kind of raised up for us in his encyclical on Mother Earth. This one is not so much a global issue of kind of Mother Earth's pollution environment, but a very specific one of drought and water. We need water to live. The human body is comprised a lot of water. Hey, Tom, how much of the human body is water? Don't they say a whole lot of it is?
I think it's like 78% or something like that.
And isn't the Earth, the planet Earth, isn't that a lot of water too?
I think I remember in school, 2/3 of the Earth is covered with water, Monsignor.
Okay, but right now, Ethiopia is currently in the midst of the worst drought that country has experienced in many years, maybe a half a century or so, and it's a very difficult situation. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that, and we're going to speak about that with somebody from Catholic Relief Services to talk about the work that they're doing to assist those communities in Ethiopia with tools that they can use to deal with, cope with, manage, and alleviate some of the pain and suffering of the drought. And then a little bit later on, we're going to speak with Dr. Alex Duval, who is the executive director of the World Peace Foundation, and he's a professor at Tufts University in Massachusetts. And we're going to kind of, again, talk more about famines and to see what's going on in the world of famine. So thank you for tuning in and joining us on Just Love today. We're in the middle of May, and actually it's a time when kind of we're moving out of our rainiest season here in the Northeast, in which we're kind of moving towards summer, which it tends to be so often a little bit drier, a little bit less rainy than it is in other times of the year. So anyway, that's what we're about to do this week. Tom, before we go to our first guest, do we have a news item that we want to share?
We do. And so, you know, as many people are aware, you know, in today's world, there's a lot of people on the move, and many people are on the move because of political situations. You know, last week we talked about religious persecution that drives some people on the move, but there's a lot of people on the move because of climate change as well. And this month, there was a disabled Syrian athlete, and his name was Ibrahim al-Hussein. He's 27 years old, and he was a competitive swimmer who in 2012 lost part of his leg during a bombing attack on that country. But he carried the Olympic torch through his new home, and his new home is the Alonis refugee camp in Greece. And then when he was running, when he was walking through with the torch, Ibrahim basically said that I'm carrying the flame for myself, but also for Syrians, for refugees everywhere, for Greece, for my sport, and for my swim team. Now, of course, Ibrahim, because he lost part of his leg, will not be able to participate in the actual Olympics. He's going to participate in the Summer Paralympics that are being held in June in Brazil, the same as the regular Olympics. But the International Olympic Committee also announced that for the first time ever, it was going to allow 10 athletes of the 43 competitive refugee athletes that the Olympic Committee has found thus far to have a refugee team in this summer's Olympics. The members of the international...
Oh, that's fascinating.
Isn't that neat?
So,
yeah.
That's fascinating. So it means they're not running for any particular country. They're kind of just running as refugees?
Yeah, they're just. In fact, they're not going to march behind a flag, Monsignor. They're going to play for or no specific country, and they're going to march behind no specific flag. They're going to come into the stadium behind the host country, Brazil, and the names of these 10 athletes are going to be announced in June. So we'll definitely wind up keeping up on the story and let you know.
I want to know more about that. That strikes me as a really, really. Whose idea was that one?
It was the International Olympics.
Your idea?
I cannot claim it once here.
Okay.
Although I think it's a great idea. But it was the International Olympic Committee. And I think, you know, given the givens, I think given probably so many athletes now are separated from their home country, I think it actually winds up making sense.
Check that one out. I want to figure out who came up with that idea. I think it's a great idea. I think we should do something to promote that. I think it's great. You know what it reminds me a little bit of? If Cardinal Dolan at Midnight Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral, he invited two refugee families to come and to pray and to be part of Midnight Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral. Well, it seems to me that that is what he did was wonderful. What the Olympic Committee is doing is wonderful. I also think what the Pope did is when he went traveling, bringing back, was it 12 or so?
It was 12. Mm-hmm.
12 refugees from the island of Lesbos.
Lesbos.
Mm-hmm. I mean, all of that, it doesn't solve the problem, but it winds up raising in consciousness the fact that we got to be aware of the fact that there are some 20 million refugees in the world and another 40 million displaced persons. So anyway, so Tom, thanks for sharing that with us. Why don't we go to our first guest, who is Kim Poziak, who is the works with Catholic Relief Services, and she tries to raise awareness, particularly about what's going on in sub-Saharan Africa. Kim, thank you so much for being a guest once more on Just Love.
Thank you for having me.
Good. And I remember we spoke probably a year or two ago, and I'm just delighted that you have the time to join us again on Just Love. So right now we got a problem in Ethiopia?
We do. Ethiopia is, as you mentioned earlier, experiencing its worst drought in 50 years. And there are currently over 10 million people that are relying on food assistance because there hasn't been rain in some areas for more than 2 years now, and therefore also no harvests and no food.
Ooh, do we know why?
Yes, the drought was brought on by the El Nino phenomenon.
Okay.
And weather experts have actually been calling this El Nino the Godzilla of all El Niños because of his strength. And so it's caused this historic drought in Ethiopia that's now being followed in some areas by flash floods because the little bit of rain that is coming cannot absorb into the ground. So that's causing even more problems now.
You know, I know you're not a meteorologist. I know that. But I don't know anything about this stuff. Can you, like, give us a little hint? So El Nino comes and now there's no rain. Give us a little bit. How what's the relationship? How's that happen?
Sure. The El Nino is a phenomenon, a current in the Pacific Ocean that in some areas causes drought. In other areas, it causes more rain and flooding. And throughout East Africa and also parts of Southern Africa this past year, or really the last 18 months or so, it's caused significant drought.
Okay. So what is it? Is it wind? Is it rain? Is it what is El Nino? Is it kind of changes in temperature? What is it?
Yeah, it causes hotter temperatures, drier air, you know, and it affects the amount and the predictability of rain. Again, in some areas, there is no rain because of it, while others are experiencing more. And I just returned from Ethiopia just a few weeks ago, and I was in areas that I visited about a year ago, and people then hadn't had any rain in a year. And they told me this time it still hasn't rained. So in some areas, people haven't had any rain to feed their crops that they depend on for more than 2 years now.
We're speaking with Kim Poziak, who is a communications officer at Catholic Relief Services. And Kim just got back from Ethiopia, where they're experiencing the worst drought in probably five decades. So Kim, share with our listeners what your trip to Ethiopia. What did you see? What did you experience? What were the surprises? And give us a sense of what you did when you were there.
I met with people throughout the country that are really affected by this current drought, but really the devastating impacts that climate change overall has had on the country over the past two decades. And really the result is that people are no longer able to predict when rain may come. They're no longer able to plan their agriculture activities because of it. And they're no longer able to harvest. So it has left a lot of people in dire need. And so Catholic Relief Services, we're doing both an emergency response where we're providing monthly food rations to more than 2 million people, almost 3 million people. But we're also looking at longer term resilience building, really giving people an ability to earn an income in a different way and become more resilient to cope with the lack of food.
So are a lot of people in Ethiopia farmers?
About 85% or so really the majority of the population, do rely on rain-fed agriculture.
What's that mean? What's that mean?
That means that they depend on rain for their crops and to have a harvest.
Does that mean 85% of them are farmers?
That is right.
Okay. That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, that's almost the entire population of Ethiopians that rely on having a harvest to feed their families and perhaps earn a small income by selling their crops in the local market.
Wow. And is it true that the crops have failed and now, because of the drought, they're producing 33% less than they used to produce?
In some areas in Ethiopia, because of the drought, the last two harvests have completely failed. In other areas, they were reduced, but some areas have had no harvest in two seasons. And the next rainy season doesn't come until later this summer, about August or so. So the months from now until then are really the most critical because people haven't been able to plant because it hasn't rained, and they're not expecting rain for at least another few months.
Wow. So it's a really dire situation.
It's a really dire situation, yes.
So tell me, if the country is 85% farmers, and part of what Catholic Relief Service is doing is kind of trying to figure out alternative kind of jobs, ways they can earn a living, what else can people in the country do?
Part of what we're doing is helping communities really understand their environment and the natural resources that are at their disposal. Because of climate change and also things like deforestation, a lot of the environment has really been degraded. So we're training communities to really rehabilitate their environment, things like building terraces on eroded hillsides so that when it does rain, the water doesn't just run off and flood their villages, and also to create more farmland. We're also teaching people different agriculture practices so they can yield a better harvest when it does rain. And things like enrolling people, especially women, in what we call savings and lending groups so they can establish a financial cushion. That has really helped a lot of people that I met with just recently even, come up with a new way of earning an income. Through these savings, people are able to buy livestock, which is very important in that part of the world. They're able to start small businesses, whether it's selling goods in the local market, and really earn an additional income to what they would have made through selling their crops from harvest.
Is that the resiliency and adaptation project that CRS is sponsoring?
That is part of that project. That is correct. In addition to the emergency food aid I mentioned earlier, we're really investing and focusing in long-term work that helps people be be able to withstand these crises on their own in the future. And that's part of it, improving agriculture activities, making more crop-resilient seeds available to farmers, rehabilitating the environment, improving irrigation systems, and then also diversifying the income that they can earn in different ways.
We're speaking with Kim Pozniak, who is with Catholic Relief Services. She just came back from visiting Ethiopia, where they're experiencing the worst drought that they've had in 50 years. Catholic Relief Services is trying to both alleviate the suffering of that drought by providing food assistance, but also looking long-term in trying to make some adaptation in order the people there can deal with the decrease in crops and how to sustain themselves going forward. You know, I noted that I think the famine in Ethiopia has gotten the attention of the U.S. government, and they're increasing their aid to Ethiopia?
Yes, they just recently made a new and additional commitment to support Ethiopians. And as a matter of fact, the food assistance that Catholic Relief Services is able to provide is thanks to the support of the U.S. government. The commodities that we make available to people, they're U.S. food commodities. And a lot of our other more long-term work is also funded through the U.S. government's international aid program.
You know, I think our listeners are probably aware of some of that, but I think it's our listeners probably are not as familiar the partnerships that go on between the U.S. government and organizations like Catholic Relief Services, Catholic Charities, and a number of other organizations helping people. And, you know, they kind of think, well, charities do their things, government do their things. But oftentimes the partnership can work out pretty well. Oh, it's got problems, and sometimes there are real difficulties with it. But the government has a tremendous number of resources at its disposal. And nonprofits like Catholic Relief Services, Catholic Charities, what they have is a great feel for the people on the grounds, and they usually have a way of providing those services that is both effective, it's efficient, it's compassionate. And so it can be a really, really nice partnership. And Catholic Relief Services really is a very, very important partner in providing those services, not only in Ethiopia, but in how many other countries is Catholic Relief Services in, Kim?
We're in more than 90 countries all over the world, and it's a good point you make in terms of partnership. And we not only work in partnership with the U.S. government, whose, you know, support we're obviously extremely grateful for, but also in partnership with the government of Ethiopia, which really has been so much better prepared to respond to this crisis than perhaps in the past. You might remember images, you know, of famine decades ago, but the government and also the partnership and the robust network of international humanitarian actors has really been able to make a difference this time, and that's why you're not seeing those same images.
You know, Kim, let me ask you a little bit of a different question, but it relates to what you're doing now. I know in the past that you worked for local television news and you were covering stories. How come we oftentimes hear that, you know, the news, the regular media doesn't really care like things about Ethiopia? They don't care about the good work that Catholic Relief Services is doing. They'd more, you know, more likely focus on a celebrity who got a DWI. From you being on the other side of the microphone or the camera, what's your take on all that?
I think you're right in some respect that obviously there are a lot of other crises around the world. We're in campaign season, election season. So I do find that most Americans really do have compassion for the people in countries like Ethiopia. They just often are at a loss of what they can do.
Kim, that's not my. Let me refocus you. I think people do have a lot of compassion. I just don't think the media cares.
Yeah, I do think that that is true in a lot of respects, and I wish that there was more coverage of underreported catastrophes like in Ethiopia and all over the world. We're not hearing about that enough, and it is so important that we do, especially as Catholics, because I think people, like I said, they do have the compassion, they do want to help, but because they're not aware, they don't know where to begin. So that's part of my job is to, really raise awareness of
what have you found in your experience works with the media? What does get their attention to, you know, get that story before their eyes, get them to kind of raise up this issue? What's worked for you?
Unfortunately, I have to say, oftentimes a situation needs to become really bad before the media start paying attention. What I try to do is really point out that there are success stories. Yes, there is suffering, but some of the long-term investment that's been made in places like Ethiopia, it is making a difference. And you're right, that is hard to get coverage of.
Yeah, it's it almost seems... I don't know I forget what that saying is, but that, you know, awful things and blood and things like that are things that make the local news at least. So it is rough. So listen, Kim, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us, and thank you for all the work that Catholic Relief Services is doing to not only alleviate the immediate assistance, the immediate pain of the famine that's going on there, but also long-term to help people look to the future. So thank you so much for being with us. Is there a website address that people can go to find out more information?
Yes, to find out more information or even support our efforts in Ethiopia, people can visit our website at crs.org.
That's pretty simple. I guess we all can remember that one. So,
yeah.
Hey, Kim, thanks for taking the time. Kim Posniak is the communications officer at Catholic Relief Service, and we've been speaking about the awful famine and the drought that's been going on in Ethiopia. I think we'll take a break now, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about this and some other topics. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a minute or so on Just Love, the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. We're talking about some of the things going on in our world that really relate to real difficulties, disasters that really get underreported. Today we're speaking about drought in Ethiopia, probably the worst one in over five decades. And not a whole lot's known about it. Not a whole lot is talked about. So we just spoke with Kim Pozniak, the communications officer at Catholic Relief Services. And then a little bit later on in our show, we're going to speak with Alex Duvall, who is the executive director of the World Peace Foundation and a professor at Tufts University. We'll continue our conversation. But, you know, we talked with Kim about the partnership between Catholic Relief Services and the government in the provision of food. And this week, there was a interesting and important Supreme Court decision regarding one of those issues of the entanglement between religious-affiliated institutions and the government, and the issue that's been all over the news for the past couple of years has been the mandate in the healthcare, Universal Health Affordable Care Act, that insurers provide contraception to women as part of their health care program. Now, I'm going to make this very simple, and there are some technical pieces to it. There is also the issue of the type of contraception that is being provided. So there are a lot of complicating issues, but I just want to kind of focus on the overview and talk about that as how we try to negotiate in the public square about how we remain faithful to a number of our moral values and our beliefs, which sometimes are in a little bit of tension in trying to figure that out. So what basically happened in this case before the Supreme Court, some of the affiliated religious organizations basically said that the Obama administration shouldn't force them to sign a piece of paper saying that they were objecting to providing the contraceptives, that was kind of too much of an entanglement. It was too much of a burden for them to do. The government argued it wasn't, and so it wound up before the Supreme Court. And as I think people are aware of, with the current situation, Supreme Court, we have eight justices, so you could get a tie vote. And the kind of the history of this Supreme Court, at least in the past number of years, has been very often you got a 5-4 decision. So with 4-4, it's not kind of just theoretical that you might get a tie. It's in fact something that is probably more than theoretical. So what the court said on this one is, it said, listen, we don't want to make any big new decisions about this. And in fact, you know, when you guys submitted your briefs, you basically said you could work this out in a way which both of you, namely the religious affiliated organizations and the government, you both said that you could come up with a way to do this in which the religiously affiliated organizations said didn't feel overly entangled in this provision of the services, the coverage that they objected to. And the government said, and we think we can work it out in a way where we can make sure, because we want to make sure that women have this coverage. And so the Supreme Court said, hey guys, you said you can, there is an option, this is feasible. So now we're not going to decide. You guys go back down and work it out. Now, that's an interesting decision, and probably didn't make everybody happy, because the side argued that they said they wanted the Supreme Court to say, they can't make religious affiliated organizations sign these documents. And there were people on the other side who were saying that, you know, there shouldn't even be any accommodation to the religiously affiliated organizations. You know, they're participating in this. They got to do it. It's the law of the land. So I'm sure there are people on both sides who were hoping for a decision one way or the other, and they would, their hopes were different. And but the Supreme Court said, hey, wait, we're not going to make any big decision about this. All we're saying is you guys told us that there's an option that is feasible. So now you go back down, and before you go back to the other court, they hopefully they're going to give you some time to work out an option that is feasible. So that's a very, very important decision. But it's also a very important thing that we are aware of in the way that we kind of have to act in the public square. There are competing values that we have as Catholic organizations, the competing values we have that the organizations want to operate in the public square. They want to be helping people. They want to partner with government. They want to be effective in trying to reach out to people of all religions to help them with the needs they have in their lives. And so that's an important value that we have. And therefore, we can't just say every time the government says you have to do something that's a problem for us, well, we're not going to play anymore, that we're just going to kind of go back because we don't like this. No, there's a value in being part of creating the common good, helping people in society. That's a Catholic value for us. At the same time, sometimes the government says, hey, we want you to do it this way, or we want you to do this as part of it. And then we have to say, well, wait a minute, we have a value that we don't want to do it that way. And so we got to negotiate this. So the Supreme Court kind of basically said, you guys work it out. We're not going to come in and make a big decision. You guys work out how you can both be faithful to what your different values or mandates are. And I think that's a pretty important value for us as part of living in society in a situation in which there's much going on in our world that doesn't, or that is contrary to our Catholic values, but we have to live in the world and figure out how we do it. The clearest example that is always given about this is the issue of taxes. Our government tax money is being used for things that are not in accord or even against our Catholic values. And yet we don't say that we can't pay taxes, but we have these kind of complicated and very sophisticated and nuanced ways that we think about these issues, about how close are we to cooperating? Do we really want it to happen, or we really say we don't want it to happen? But, you know, even though we don't want it to happen, we have to do something in accord with those values. Obviously, the other area which always comes up is when doctors and nurses and medical students, when there are the question of abortion, that when as part of their rotations, their rounds, they're expected to participate in certain ways in those type of activities, which we find to be morally objectionable. And so I mention this because we had a good example with the Supreme Court basically saying, hey, work it out. Figure out a way you both can be faithful to your values, because there's a partnership here. There's a way that we need to go forward, and we have to figure out a way to do that for the sake of the common good. So anyway, let's take a break. Just love God, yourself, neighbor. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back, and we'll continue talking about the drought in Ethiopia and what's being done to alleviate that. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Thank you. To Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. We call it Just Love because if we just love God, just love our neighbor, and just love ourselves, then we've loved three pretty important people, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. We're talking this week about a topic that, you know, hasn't gotten a lot of play in the media in this country. The worst famine, drought in Africa in about 50 years or so. And we're trying to kind of raise it up to try to make people aware of what's going on there, some of the assistance that currently being provided, and also talking a little bit about maybe some of the progress that has been made so that we can get a little bit of hope that if we do address some of these issues, that things might be a little bit better. And so I'm delighted that we have on as our guest now Alex Duvall, who is the executive director of the World Peace Foundation and a research professor at Tufts University. Alex, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Alex, so, you know, I was talking before to our previous guest, and, you know, some of these issues don't get raised up a whole lot. Clearly, Ethiopia is not kind of on the top 10 of tourist spots. It's not on the top 10 even of news items in this country. How'd you get interested in the topic, in the topics that you're concerned about now?
Well, I think like many people of my generation, I was very energized by the issue of humanitarian action back in the 1980s, at a time when Bob Geldof and others were raising a lot of noise, literally musical noise, about the issue. In fact, I was already in Africa when Bob Geldof's song "Do They Know It's Christmas" came out in December 1984. And at that time, the big issue was major famines, major starvation. I mean, in 1984-85. Somewhere between 600,000 and 1 million Ethiopians, most of them children, starved to death in a really terrible calamity, the worst famine of that decade. And I was there, among others, to help as a volunteer. Also, I ended up doing research, doing my PhD on the topic in the 1980s.
When you looked at that, what specifically did you do research on?
Well, I was interested in how people actually survived famine, and on what famine looked like, as it were, from the people who suffered it. You know, how they coped and how they were remarkably resilient and creative in getting through the sorts of hardships that most of us could never even dream about. And I was most impressed by these people. These were the real experts.
How did they do it? How did they get by?
Well, they rationed their food. They collected wild foods. Many of the women in Sudan and Ethiopia, particularly the older women, particularly the grandmothers, were real experts at going off into the forest or the wilds and finding nuts and berries and grasses that you wouldn't normally eat and turning them into food. They migrated to look for work. They were tremendously resourceful and hardy people, but despite all that, of course, many of them died in these terrible events.
You know, Alex, if I could just relate for a moment, I just went to Iraq and visited some of the displaced persons camp up in Kurdistan. And the word that I kept saying over and over to myself is resilience, that these were camps, they were very cramped. The thousands of people had been displaced overnight. And so it's an awful situation. And yet, some 20 months after they were displaced, there's kind of a village societal kind of structure that has emerged. And what I was amazed at, in the refugee camps, there are these little mom and pop stores that have sprung up, in which, you know, they're selling water sometimes, they're selling cooked food. There was even a guy who had set up a little bit of a shoe repair shop. So when you say that, the resilience, the creativity and how people cope, boy, it struck a chord with me because of what I just experienced.
I think that's absolutely true. And that also points to the other main thing that I was looking at, which was the fact that what was actually driving the crisis, actually causing people to fail to survive, was not drought. It was not natural adversity. It was politics. It was the fact that in Ethiopia at that time, the government, the then government, was waging a terrible war against rebels, and it was using food as a weapon. It was bombing markets. It was preventing people from trading food. It was burning fields. It was rounding up peasants and forcibly relocating them, and it was blocking aid agencies from getting into the area. And when those famine-creating actions were stopped, when the government was overthrown a few years later, 1991, and you got a government in power that may not be angels, but they at least they're not fighting their own people, at least they have sensible policies for economic growth and for nutrition, etc. And which means that people are, you know, farmers are able to farm, you know, herders are able to herd their cattle in peace. Suddenly the scourge of famine begins to fade. And I was in Ethiopia again just recently, and there's an even more severe drought, you know, less water, more crops failing. But whereas, you know, 30 years ago, 500,000 or more people would die in this sort of drought, today no one is dying. The government actually is coping. And whereas the economy shrank by 14-15% in 1984-85 during that famine, today Ethiopia year on year is growing around 10%. This year the growth is being cut. It's being cut to somewhere like 7-8%. Now, to grow 7-8% during a terrible drought, that's quite an achievement. And it reflects, you know, the success of this Ethiopian government and the international donors, but primarily the government, having a good, sensible, honest government in power in overcoming the problem of famine.
You know, I spoke...
Tremendous achievement.
Alex, I spoke previous with my previous guest, who is a kind of communications person, and she's been on both sides of trying to find a story and now trying to pitch stories. And what we spoke about was how situations like this don't get covered, and they don't make the mainstream news in the United States. And in fact, I think there are some of us who I have on my radio, BBC World Service, because sometimes we get at least a little bit more coverage of what's going on in the rest of the world than we do on kind of mainstream network news in the United States. But the point I wanted to make, which I'd like your reaction to, is it when we do get a story about something going on in Africa, it only becomes a story if it's a horrendous, disastrous tragedy where buildings are coming down and people and, you know, kids with bloated stomachs and everything's failing. We don't get a story about if there's some hope and progress.
I think that's absolutely correct. When I was in Ethiopia, I met a lot of journalists, foreign journalists especially, and they were all going out looking for the famine. And, you know, I hate to say this, but they were actually disappointed. They couldn't find starving people. And so they weren't writing stories. They said, there's no story here. Well, hold on a moment. Here we have a country that a generation ago, people of, you know, my generation and older, for them, Ethiopia is synonymous. Ethiopia means starving children. It means terrible things happening. And today you have an Ethiopia where that's not happening. And surely that's a news item. And it's actually not just Ethiopia. We at World Peace Foundation have done a study of famines over the last 150 years. And between the 1870s and the 1980s, you know, there were about every decade on decade, about 10 million people would die in these terrible famines here. Famines in Mao's, famines in Asia, famines in Bengal, war famines in Eastern Europe associated with the Soviet Union or the Nazis, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the number of people dying in famines is about 5% of that level. It's great famines have been reduced almost to zero. It's very, very rare to have these events. And that is an enormous global achievement. And the question we were asking ourselves is, how did this come about? And it seems that the main reason actually is politics, and a particular form of politics. It's popular action. It's democratic accountability. It's when you no longer have communist dictatorships in China, when you no longer have wars of counterpopulation, wars of obliteration in Eastern Europe or in Southeast Asia. You no longer have the Mao Zedongs, the Pol Pots, the Mengistu Haile Mariams. He was the military dictator of Ethiopia 30 years ago. And instead you have, you know, decent government in which people can live their lives and call their governments to account. Then suddenly famines vanish. Isn't it wonderful?
It certainly is. And again, if I go back to BBC that I was listening to sometime in the past year or so, I was just hearing this incredible, hopeful story about how the change in agricultural technology in Africa over the past decade or so has reduced the level of food insecurity, of hunger in a number of different countries in Africa.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, the new farming technologies, the new ways of using water more efficiently, of irrigation, better seeds, etc., they're all tremendously effective. And what's allowing it to happen is better government, more democratic government, more accountable government at all levels.
Now, again, I'm not being partisan when I say the thing I'm going to say next. What you say just seems to me to be really on target, probably maybe a little bit, not necessarily counterintuitive, but people might think more technology, more of those type of things, but it's kind of having the structure there to let the technology and let the things work. And again, I'm not being partisan. I'm just saying, and then I get depressed when the United States is entering into a kind of political campaign in which the basic core kind of political structures are really being beaten around. And that's such a critical piece to economic growth, for well-being of people, to making sure that there is advancement and not stagnation.
And actually worse than that, I would say, because if you look at several of the really serious cases in recent times of mass starvation, one of them was Somalia 5 years ago. Another is a few places in Syria now. And yes, the warring parties in those countries, you know, terrible militant groups, you know, ruthless people like Bashar al-Assad, they are causing it. But one of the hindrances that that we face, that humanitarian agencies, charities face in trying to assist these people, is that if you are a civilian living in an area controlled by the militant group al-Shabaab in Somalia, for example, any international agency that comes in to try and to help you is at risk of being prosecuted under the Patriot Act for deliberately or inadvertently giving support to a terrorist organization. And, you know, the Patriot Act was not designed with these circumstances in mind. And the U.S. government, USAID and others, are trying to get around it. But nonetheless, it is a huge hindrance on essential humanitarian work, life-saving work in these operations. If you can't operate for fear that someone may point a finger and say, actually, the guy you just did a deal with, he's associated with a terrorist group. And I think there is if this problem gets worse, we're going to have an escalation of starvation in places where there is the war on terror is on its front lines, as it were. And I think this is not only ethically wrong, it's also just bad politics. It's going to turn a lot of people against the United States.
That's a very interesting, and again, in a very minor way, I just know that even when my work at Catholic Charities, sometimes when we open a new bank account, the rigmarole that you have to go through in terms of getting everybody's Social Security number and the board of directors and all of that stuff, because they're so afraid money laundering and all of those type of things, you know, and you're trying to run a soup kitchen or a food pantry, you know, in a neighborhood, and it, you got to go through all these hoops. I can just imagine what you have to do if you're trying to provide humanitarian aid in a really sensitive, troubled, divided part of the world, as you just, you know, explained.
Yeah, and it's particularly the case for Muslim charities. I know there are a lot of Muslim community organizations in Europe, you know, just run by decent, ordinary people who are trying to help, and they the cloud of suspicion they have to operate under is deeply, deeply problematic.
Hey, I just want to say a word of thanks to you for taking the time to be with us on Just Love and kind of raising up some, you know, good news in the midst of what is still an awful famine, an awful situation, but realizing that progress has been made, and that even in those places which maybe in kind of the mainstream image that we all have are still awful, backward, whatever, that progress can be made and that people's lives can be better. So, Alex Duvall, thanks so much for being with us, and thanks for your work as Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation.
You're very welcome. It's great to be
with you. Great. Have a good day. So, Tom, you got one short news story that you want to share with us?
I do, Mr. You know, and it ties in a little bit with food. Earlier this month, in Italy, actually, the Italian Supreme Court, the highest court in the country, ruled that a Ukrainian immigrant, Roman Ostrovsky, committed no crime last year, and he would face no jail time for stealing what amounted to $4.70 worth of cheese and sausage from a Genoa supermarket. In doing so, the court said he took possession of a small amount of food, and because of his immediate need for nourishment, and the act therefore was, as they said, they did not expect him to do the impossible to justify their ruling. So it didn't take long, obviously, for this court case to kind of go viral. Many people were comparing Mr. Ostrovsky to Jean Valjean and Victor Hugo's Les Miserables. And I think it should be interesting. So, you know, in the autumn, Pope Francis is going to have homeless people come for the end of the pontifical year of mercy. So it'll be interesting to see if Mr. Ostrovsky is part of that group.
Well, it was $4.70.
Yep, $4.70 worth of sausage and cheese.
And did he get caught?
He did.
So did he have the food on him?
Yeah, I think he already made. I didn't say. I'm sure he must have eaten it.
Okay, because otherwise, all he could do is give it back.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting thing. I mean, obviously, we're not in favor of people stealing, and we're not in favor of them stealing even a little bit, as $4.70 is. But at the same time, you know, there's got to be the recognition that, boy, for some people, they need that amount of food. And quite frankly, that's why we have so many food pantries, we have so many soup kitchens, because there is a tremendous need for people to have food in this country. And the price of food is growing, it's increasing tremendously. And in so many parts of the country, the price of housing, be it rent or how much people have to pay for a mortgage. And at the end of the day, you need food, you need shelter. And so oftentimes with people with low incomes, that's the big competition. They pay the rent, do they get food? And quite frankly, I think, you know, most people, if they can, they choose the option of paying the rent because they don't want to be without a home. And then they scrounge to figure out how they're going to pay for the food. And fortunately, there are food pantries for which that is a very, very significant way that they supplement their food. Tom, I don't know if you're aware of this, but at least in the New York metropolitan area, and I think probably throughout the country, we've discovered more and more is that a number of the people, and in some places many of the people who are coming to our food pantries are people who are actually working. And that, you know, the typical image of maybe somebody who's a substance abuser, somebody who is living on the street, they show up at the food pantry. Sure, a lot of those people do, and, you know, we try to treat them with dignity, with compassion. But there are a lot of grandmoms who come in to feed their grandchildren. You know, we've now opened some of our pantries in the evening because people come in after work to come there. So Anyway, so Tom, thank you. And we've been talking about famine and some of the positive stuff going on in Africa to alleviate the famine that is in Ethiopia. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love God, yourself, and neighbor. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us again next week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.